Of Artificer Creation.
Welcome to episode 153 of the Let's Talk Photography podcast. I'm your host, Bart Buchholz, and this is the show for June 2026. The topic today is on the, it's a very big picture topic, but about the art rather than the craft of photography. And I want to sort of explain how I think about composing images as very much a sort of, if you'll excuse the pun, given what's going on in the world at the moment, a game of two halves. So on the one hand, I have guiding principles that I stick to rigidly. Well, those principles may evolve over time as my style evolves, but those principles are kind of what define what a what does a photograph look like that I like, and therefore those guiding principles have kind of been reverse engineered from how I like my photographs to look. And to use those principles, I am happy to choose to use guidelines. But guidelines are very different to principles. Guidelines are always optional. When they're helpful, use them. When they're not helpful, don't. But more than that, those guidelines have a hidden context. So sometimes, not only do you want to ignore them, you actually want to do something even more sort of proactive. You want to invert them, because what you want is the opposite of what the guideline was designed to promote. This episode has a little bit of a backstory. So late last year, I presented to a wonderful group called the Naples Mac User Group, or NMUG, who are a group of Mac users, technically based in Florida, or Naples in Florida, but they cater to a worldwide audience, and thanks to the joys of modern technology, that's something they really can do. And they invited me on to present a talk about how I use an iPhone to get nice photographs. So basically, the craft of iPhone photography. And some parts of that talk actually were quite useful for this show. So Let's Talk Photography 145 was an adaptation of parts of that presentation as an episode of this show. So I was invited back, and this time they were like, look, fun talk, great, really loved it. But, you know, you're actually quite good at presenting about that artistic stuff. Would you like to come back and do a talk focusing on the art rather than the craft? I was like, oh, yes, I would. So I submitted a talk about composition. And the actual slides I presented them a few weeks ago. It was, as is always the case with this group, a really fun presentation to give. They're such an engaging and such a nice group. I'm always happy when they invite me because they really are so nice to present to. And so it was on composition, and the actual presentation I gave to them was extremely visual. I mean, that's the whole, when you have the luxury of a visual medium and your topic is photography, hey, lean in. So most of the slides were just images with annotations. So little faux post-it notes explaining how those images relate to the concepts being discussed. And it worked great as a presentation, but it would make an awful podcast episode. But actually, one of the things I'm very careful to try to achieve when I design any presentation is to have a story to tell, to have an arc, a narrative arc with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and to then use that as the backbone of the presentation. And that those concepts that make up that narrative arc are not visual or anything else. They are just basically an argument, if you want to call it that. My sort of view on things laid out in a coherent way. Well, that flow of concepts is every bit as valid in a podcast as it was in a visual presentation. It just needs to be adapted a little bit. And that's what this episode is. Now, the actual show notes, I didn't rewrite everything as new show notes. I could have, I guess, written that as an essay format. But I'll be honest, finite amount of time, I didn't do that. What I did instead was the same thing I did last year. I have taken my slide deck and I've sort of abridged it. I've excerpted it into a smaller deck, which is basically going to serve as the show notes for this episode. The images have been removed, which means what's left is the narrative arc, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And really, it's all about how I approach composing an image, because there's infinity possible ways to compose an image. There is no right answer to how do you compose an image. So, well, I can't tell you how you compose an image, but I can describe how I go about it, and maybe you can adapt my method into your own. Not as in you will compose your photos like I do, but maybe you'll be able to think about composition like I do. You will end up doing it completely differently because you're not me. And what I think looks good and what you think looks good are not the same thing at all. But sort of my approach of breaking it into principles and guidelines that I hope is universally useful. So that's kind of the arc here. So your guiding principles sort of fall out of what you think looks good. And your guiding principles will help you to develop your photographic style. And I was going to say they're not negotiable. And to some extent, they do change over time as you mature, as your style shifts. But they're more like climate, I guess. They're slow to evolve. Guidelines, on the other hand, are completely optional. And when they're useful, they're just general little snippets of wisdom that come from other photographers. And I would say they are suggestions. Good suggestions with a reason behind them. Useful suggestions that have been proven over time, and therefore they should be a part of your toolbox. But just because something's in your toolbox doesn't mean you have to use it all the time. And these guidelines are not rules. Some of them have the word rule in the name, which is misleading, but utterly wrong. The rule of thirds isn't a rule that every well-composed photograph must fit the rule of thirds. That's literally not what it is. The rule of thirds is a guideline to help you compose images that look good when the situation suits, when that particular approach to composition works for you. But that's just an approach. And so you just pick and choose the guidelines that fit with the scene you're photographing. Don't feel bound by them. They are tools to help you, not constraints to confine you. And not only can you ignore them, which is easy to do, just don't do them, but actually, when you understand them, you can do the opposite of ignore them. You can invert them. You can break them with intention. And the reason for that is that the rules all have a silent because after them. So the rule of thirds is a way of making compositions that feel harmonious. What if you don't want that? Well, what if you want something that feels really jarring? Don't just not obey it, break it. Actually, the rule of thirds isn't the world's best example. Say, one of my favourite things to do is to give subjects room to look into. But that, there's a hidden why. The why of giving subjects room to look into is because it makes the picture feel harmonious, not cramped, not claustrophobic, but natural and free and open, relaxing. That's how I like my photographs a lot of the time. But what if I need to tell the opposite story? What if I need to capture a sense of drama, a sense of claustrophobicness, a sense of edginess? Do the bloody opposite. Crop it right at the person's nose. Right? It will feel the opposite of harmonious, because you've inverted the rule. And so the guideline. So, you know, really, a lot of the rules are just in your best sort of Pirates of the Caribbean. They're more like guidelines. So I really do stress that they are guidelines and treat them as such. And they're worth learning because they will tell you when they're relevant and when they're not. And when you really understand them, when breaking them will actually make your photograph better, when you can break them with deliberation because you want the opposite of what the guideline is designed to encourage. So that's sort of the background here. So let's start with what I think are the principles you can use to help you build your style. And I did. It took me a long time. I had 6 months to write this presentation. Thank goodness I had 6 months to write this presentation, because the vague idea, that came to me pretty quickly. But distilling it into its essence is bloody difficult, right? My first draft of any presentation has no shortage of words. It has far too bloody many words. And the real skill of honing a presentation is not adding words, but subtracting them. Or not really subtracting, it's a little more complicated than that. It's replacing many words with better, fewer words. And it took me a while, but I wanted to get my four guiding principles down to single words. And eventually the penny dropped, all four pennies dropped, and for me, the guiding principles I think of are attentiveness, understanding, intuition, and as counterintuitive as this sounds, selfishness. So for attentiveness, think of it as get out right in camera as much as you can. Don't try to fix it in post. Pay attention as you're shooting. And you don't have to get everything right, but you should try to get as much of it right as you can, because that will make your life so much easier. And by being attentive, you will come home with better photographs. It doesn't really matter what your style is. Attentiveness is a guiding principle that you should just always obey. Understanding, then, is how you leverage guidelines. So by understanding the guidelines, you know when they're a good option and when they're a bad option and when and how to break them. So a lot of what I've been talking about, I have distilled into the word understanding. Break the rules well, or use them when they're helpful. Intuition, I think, is something that is very, very important to keep in mind, because if you misunderstand guidelines as rules, then you end up measuring things. Is this horizon exactly on a one-thirds line? Is this flower exactly in the center? So you're measuring. But that's not what gets a good composition. What gets a good composition is that it feels right. And so you can use the guideline to get you close, and then you ignore the guideline until it feels right. So intuition is surrendering exactness in exchange for looking at the photograph and going, I like that. That's correct. That's right for me. Not it's right by some guideline. It's right for me. It's your photographic style here. So intuition, listen to your intuition, obey your intuition. Do not become a slave to math. Don't, you know, it's not about it being exactly half or exactly a third or exactly the golden ratio. It's about your intuition. And then we get the selfishness. Selfishness is the luxury of the amateur. And might leave that as a little bit of a teaser. So I want to spend a little more time on each of those four principles. And then with that context laid, I want to talk about some guidelines that I find helpful. There are infinitely more guidelines that other people find helpful. So this is a collection of suggestions, some of which you will find helpful and some of which you won't. The guidelines, the guiding principles, I think are relevant to everyone. The guidelines are a menu from which you pick the things you like. So let's jump to those four principles: attentiveness, understanding, intuition, and selfishness. Starting with attentiveness, when you can, get it right in camera. First and foremost, minimize the easy fixes, right? Just ask yourself some questions while you're looking at, you know, while you're looking through the quote-unquote viewfinder, or at your screen probably in this day and age. When you're shooting the shot, ask yourself a few simple questions. Is it level? Right? If you're intending it to be level, is it actually level? If you're intending it to be off level, is it far enough off level that it doesn't feel accidental? Could keystoning ruin this? If so, am I approximately face on to this thing that needs to be square? Because if you are face on, it will be square. If you're close to face on, it will be close enough that you can fix it in post. But if you're way off the mark, you're better make a composition where keystoning is a feature, not a bug. Because you are going to have the keystoning, so be deliberate about it. Pay attention to the fact that it is going to be a thing. And the other kind of obvious one is the exposure as good as you can get it at the moment, right? You're going to have to do a little bit of work in post to finesse it, but try get the exposure halfway right in camera. It's a lot easier. Like, you can't invent data. If the data isn't captured, you've kind of lost it. And yeah, sure, we can use generative AI to kind of invent some different data that might look like it once belonged there. But is that photography? Well, that's a difficult question. Probably a whole other talk. Let's sidestep that one. But, you know, get the exposure decent when you can. So minimize easy fixes. Avoid difficult fixes. Yes, you can do things like, you know, intelligent cloning and generative fill and all of these kind of things with modern AI. It has made some of these difficult fixes a bit less difficult. But again, they're more faffing about, and they have all sorts of ifs and buts, and you're just easier to not have to deal with them. So again, it's about being attentive and asking yourself questions as you shoot the shot. Is there anything poking in from the edges that I'd have to clone out afterwards? If there is it unavoidable? Maybe it is, in which case I'll either make it a feature of the image by making it not poke in but be a part of the composition, or I'll move to get it out of the way, or I'll just minimize it and accept the fact that there's a difficult fix on the way afterwards. Okay, fair enough. Are there avoidable distractions? Sure, with generative fill, you can remove things a lot better now than you used to be able to. Or at least with a lot less faffing about than it used to take. But it still takes some faffing about, and the generative fill doesn't always look great. You know, it may be somewhat misleading. So if there are distractions you can avoid, well, avoid them. And again, with generative fill, if you crop too tight, you can invent some data around the edge of your scene to get back to a pleasing composition. But might it be easier to just shoot a little bit wide and leave yourself enough room around the subject? So, minimize the easy fixes, avoid the difficult fixes, but above all else, auga, auga, beware the unfixable. If you mess up the focus, you've messed up the focus. Nothing I have seen of any of this AI stuff has convinced me of the concept that Asher will focus afterwards. Get the focus right. If you're using a phone, tap to focus on the thing you want to be in focus. If you're using a traditional camera, make sure the focus point is where it's supposed to be. Make sure the focus mode is what's going to work. Right, don't mess up the focus. Remember, the world is a three-dimensional place and your photograph is a two-dimensional thing. If there are background mergers, you have yourself a giant big mess. A stop sign sprouting out of someone's head. Yeah, you might get away with cloning it out, maybe. But where it touches the head is going to be a giant big mess. And really, I still consider background mergers, so basically where the three-dimensional world collapses into two-dimensional image catastrophically badly, I consider that to be an unfixable problem. We may argue that may move into the difficult fixes category at some point in the future, but I'm leaving it here for now. And a distracting background is just a distracting background. I mean, yeah, okay, remove the subject completely and plonk it on another image. Well, that is an image, and it might be creative. It's not a photograph anymore. And so, at that point, you're into graphic design. Graphic design is an amazing art. I am not in any way denigrating graphic design. But I'm here to talk about the art and craft of photography. I know next nigh or nothing about graphic design. My understanding of graphic design is like my understanding of wine. I know what I like. Might even be able to explain why I like it. Can't make wine. Can't do graphic design. So that's attentiveness. Understanding then. Well, know the rules to break the rules well. So all rules have this silent context, this hidden why. Give moving objects room to move into, so your composition doesn't feel claustrophobic. Give people room to look into, so your portrait feels balanced. There's your hidden whys. If you want the opposite, do the opposite. If you're wondering whether or not this guideline is useful, Well, the hidden why will tell you whether the guideline is relevant or not. Do I really care about whether or not my composition feels claustrophobic? Well, then giving the moving object room is just not a thing to consider, so maybe I'll think about something else. Giving people room to look into, that's kind of one where you probably do want to make a choice, but maybe you don't. Maybe you don't actually care. Maybe there's way more important things to get right. I don't know. This silent context is generally usually what you want, right? You usually don't want your compositions to feel claustrophobic. You generally want your portraits to feel balanced. We, as a human being, as a species, we prefer pleasing images over striking images that force us to feel discomfort, right? There are times we need that, and there are times when, as a photographer, you try your darndest to make people uncomfortable when they look at your image. But more often than not, we would prefer people to find our images pleasing, in which case the guidelines are helpful because they're a mechanism towards making pleasing images. When you want to do the opposite, do the opposite. Break the rules, but don't just break them a little bit, because that will feel like a whoopsie, like an accident. I have coined a term that I don't know if it'll ever take off, but I hope it does. It's not the uncanny valley, because we're not trying to fake reality. It's the sloppy valley. It feels like we didn't actually mean it. Our horizon is quite level. It's not off-level enough to make the point that we intended the image to make you feel drunk. It's just like we missed. So if you're going to break the rules, break the rules. Don't do it by half. I keep saying rules when I should be saying guidelines, but you know what I mean. Don't do it by half. The sloppy valley makes your photograph look not amateur in the true and genuine sense of the word, but amateur in the pejorative sense of the word. So don't do it by half. You either ignore the guideline or you break it with deliberation. But you don't sort of kind of break it. So, intuition. Feels right, beats measured exactly. I sort of feel like I've already done this one to death, because really there isn't much more to say. The rules are just guidelines. And, you know, not only are they just guidelines, mostly they're just suggestions. It's even weaker sounding than guidelines. Think of them as suggestions, ideas, things you might consider. Photographs, certainly from my point of view, given the type of photography we talk about here, are an art. They're not a science, which means that while, you know, I have a science degree, I am a scientist by training, I know that there is a concept of something being actually right. But in art, you don't measure things to check if they're right. In art, if it feels right, it is right. The definition of something that is artistically truthful to you is your feeling about it. So when you're in artistic creative mode, if it feels right, it is right. And numeric guides like desirable ratios are approximate suggestions. The rule of thirds, think of them as not lines to align your composition to, but fuzzy bands to aim vaguely near in your composition, and that'll work just grand. This is something I really hammered home in the visual version of this talk, where I showed the photographs and saying, yeah, you see here, we know we're a rule of thirds, we have a vertical element here, yada yada. And then I put the actual rule of thirds grid up, and it's like, well, it's nearly there, but it still feels right. And I just, you know, when I measure it, it's saying, oopsie, you missed. Only I didn't miss. It was feels right, and that's all that matters. So now that last counterintuitive guiding principle, selfishness. We often think of it as a pejorative, because there are many, many times in life when being selfish is not a good thing. But when you have the luxury of being an amateur photographer, you can and should be selfish. And amateur, like selfishness, is another one of these words that comes with baggage, and so I'm using it here to be a little bit provocative. Because in our modern world, we've decided to redefine amateur as an antonym of professional. And we've chosen to redefine professional as good. Professional actually means it is a thing you do for money. It is your profession. Amateur has a root when you understand where the word comes from, it has a root very much like professional. It's not about quality, it's about money. So a professional does things for money, an amateur does things for the love of doing it. It comes from the French amateur, which means lover or enthusiast. So an amateur photographer is a photographer who makes photographs for the love of making photographs. That means there's no client. You're not meeting a brief. Your pay doesn't depend on the quality of your work because you're not doing it professionally. You're doing it for the love of doing it. That gives you the freedom to do what you want, to please yourself, to make photographs that bring you joy. You can express yourself. And that used to be easier. So if you do it for money, you have to do it, you know, the customer's always right. Easy. But even when you think you're doing it for fun, our modern world is just designed to make absolutely sure that no one does anything for fun anymore. Because a lot of us have been, and it's not an accident, have been dragged into the addictive sphere of social media, and not the pleasant, fun kind of social media you get from genuinely healthy communities, but the kind of deeply toxic social media you get from companies who monetize attention. They're not there to help you. They're there so that you can help them make as much money as possible. And they have figured out how to engineer your brain to be fixated on their website, and their algorithm has hijacked your brain because it's designed to do that. And they're bloody good at it, and they have a lot of resources. So it is very easy to unthinkingly fall into the trap of changing your photographic style to match whatever gets the most likes on social media. The algorithm doesn't care about your creativity. If you do it where you are a slave to the algorithm, are you an amateur? You're now a slave worker of the algorithm. That's worse than a professional by a massive long shot. A professional, there's a customer, at least you get paid. If you just unthinkingly follow the algorithm, you've been recruited to do labor for someone else's profit, not your own. That's worse. So don't give two hoots about what the keyboard warrior thinks is good, or what the keyboard warrior thinks is bad, or what the algorithm tries to reinforce into you as good. You are you. You have the luxury of selfishly making the pictures you want to make. And the thing is, when you share those pictures in non-toxic communities, in actual communities, in other words, you will find others who appreciate them for what they are. This comes back to something I just keep going on about. Why do I pay to be a member of the Glass photographic community, glass.photo? I could post for free on Threads or the place that was once Twitter and is now some sort of right-wing lunatic hellscape. Or I could pay with actual money to be in a place where it's there to serve me and my fellow photographers. We're all paying members in Glass, which means the algorithm is there to make me want to keep renewing my membership. It means that everything about the site is designed to make me as happy as I can be. Not as attentive, not as trapped, but as genuinely happy. So that's why I'm there. Why am I on Mastodon? There is no algorithm. My feed is a list of things that happen in the order they happened. That is so liberating. And lo and behold, after you've posted your images for a while, you develop a following because, hey, there are people out there who appreciate your particular style of photography, and it might take them a while to find you without an algorithm trying to wire their brains. But when they find you, they find you. So be selfish. Shoot what makes you happy. Obey your creative instincts. Express yourself. Be selfish. Okay. With all of that said and all of that context, what are some guidelines I find helpful to actually instrumentize or, you know, deliver compositions that work for me? Well, the rule of thirds I find actually genuinely useful a lot of the time. And if you don't know what the rule of thirds is, it's that grid. That grid you just see everywhere. Like, you can turn it on your iPhone. A lot of cameras in the olden days had it etched into the screen, literally. It's two parallel lines, one third of the way down from the top and one third of the way up from the bottom of the screen or the frame. And two more parallel lines crossing them, one third of the way in from the left and one third of the way in from the right. In other words, one third up, one third in, one third down, and one third in from the other side. And those lines are pleasing places for long, thin elements of your composition. So vertical and horizontal elements are pleasing to the eye when they're approximately aligned to one of those four lines. Where those four lines cross are broad, vague zones where having some sort of a main subject is a way of achieving a pleasing composition. A way. Not the way. A way. And not exactly on the crossing line, but vague zones where those lines cross. And those lines, remember, are fuzzy too. So think of it as a heat map, where there are strong areas where it's good to have horizontal and vertical elements. So think, you know, darker red on the heat map, two parallel, you know, four darker red lines. And then four dark red zones, circular zones around the crossing points of the vague, fuzzy, dark red areas or lines, right? Think of it as a heat map is probably best, but it's approximate, around, about, not a rule, a suggestion. A little bit more fuzzy than the rule of thirds is the concept of visual weight. And I'm going to outsource my definition here because it's a very arty-farty, hand-waving-y sort of term. You know it when you see it, or rather you'll know when you don't have it when you don't have it. And you won't even think about it when you do. So when something is visually balanced, you don't think about it. It's like IT that works. No one thinks about it. No one thinks to send the IT department a message saying, hey, everything works, thank you. Because everything's working and you're doing your job. The fact that there's a whole kit and caboodle of technology under the hood doesn't mean a darn to you because you're interested in doing whatever it is you're supposed to be doing. Visual weight is kind of like that. When your image is visually balanced, you don't even realize it is. Because it's not, it doesn't feel wrong. It's just, okay, great. When you get it wrong, it feels visually unbalanced. And that's what you got to deal with. Unless you're trying to make an image that feels unbalanced. Okay, so I outsourced a description of this to the privacy-respecting AI chatbot Lumo, which I pay for because, again, algorithms are bad. No, that's not fair. Algorithms designed to monetize you against your will secretly without giving you informed consent are bad. Algorithms designed to help you are good. Anyway, this is not Let's Talk Security, so let's get off that train. Lumo is nice because I pay for it, therefore it tries to please me instead of trying to use me to train the model. Anyway, right. I asked it to describe this concept of visual weight and visual balance, and this is what I got, and I think it's a very good sentence. Visual weight is the relative amount of attention an element draws within a photograph's composition. So different bits of the image are going to grab your eye to different extents. Lumo continues, think of it as visual gravity. Some elements pull the eye more strongly than others. So, the better your visual balance, the more harmonious your composition will feel. It's very subconscious, by the way. So, you're generally speaking better off to consider the balance before you fire the shutter. So this is extra true when your compositions are, when your crop factors, when your crops you're going to produce are further away from square. So a panorama, it's extra important. So imagine you have a very eye-catching thing very close to the right of a long, wide panorama, and there's nothing at all on the left. That is going to feel like all the visual gravity is over to the right and there's nothing on the left and the whole image just feels really unbalanced. So if you got something really strong on the left, maybe your primary subject, maybe a red car or something. Well, if you have some sort of a, you know, a tree framing the opposite corner, that tree isn't going to grab your eye in the sense of, it's, you know, it's now taken over the photograph. You now have two subjects competing. But the tree does add visual gravity, which means that the composition will feel balanced, that that framing element will counteract the primary subject without becoming the primary subject, unless somehow it's a bright pink tree. But generally speaking, you will end up with the other piece of one piece of visual weight being designed to grab the eye and the other piece being designed to add weight without being to play a worthy second fiddle. Sometimes, of course, you do actually have two subjects because you're telling a story of this and that. Something I end up with a lot, because it's a story that my landscape is full of, is the fact that we have a railway line and a canal that run in parallel with each other for literally hundreds of miles, well, at least 100 miles. And so that means there is a constant story of two, which means I very often end up using very, you know, skinny, but sorry, not tall, but very wide compositions with things like a boat on one side and a train on the other side, and they're balancing each other out. So that's an, you know, an intentional two subjects. But again, they need to be in balance. So that's just something to bear in mind. And if you take a photograph and it isn't visually balanced, the best way to fix it is with a crop. And don't feel that you have to crop to the aspect ratio of the camera happened to be. Crop to any aspect ratio that makes the photograph feel right. If it feels right, it is right. Okay. I'm preaching here, but you get the idea. Something else that can be really useful for making a catching photograph is geometry and symmetry. And geometries and symmetries come all over the place. So just finding sort of a vague big picture shape can give you a strong composition, like a strong diagonal element. I will go out of my way if I'm shooting something where there's a branch to try to get that branch to go from bottom corner to the opposite corner on the top or whatever, right? Try getting a strong diagonal. As well as getting a strong diagonal, sometimes you actually end up with these big, vague shapes. So if you can imagine a square crop of a butterfly with its wings open, if you compose that butterfly so the front straight edge of the wing is at 45 degrees and going from corner to corner, then the body of the butterfly will take up the lower triangle of your image. And whatever it is the butterfly is looking into with its head and its big pointy antennae, those make up the other side of the image. So you have two triangles giving you a triangular composition. A central circle is a very powerful composition. So if you have a flower, shoot it exactly face on and put it smack dab in the middle, and, you know, ignore that rule of thirds, not relevant, and you will have a very interesting circle-based composition. And then geometry is also just found around you. Architecture can have amazing geometric shapes. Macros can have amazing geometric shapes hiding in plain sight. And then you have all the different symmetries. You have reflections, you have grids, you have repeating grids, you have rotations. And a little subtlety here is that something that's nearly symmetric is actually more pleasing to our eye than something that's actually symmetric. A broken symmetry is something our brains love. And I think it's because nature is almost symmetrical, but rarely perfect. A flower is never a perfect circle. And I think that makes something feel natural. Now, our eyes love a broken symmetry. So the next guideline is shoot from their level. It is very easy to walk around the world with your point of view at human eye level and to take your photographs at human eye level. But not the whole world is full of things that are not at human eye level. There are things that exist way lower down than you. There are things that exist way higher up than you. And one way to turn what would otherwise be a snapshot into something interesting is to get your camera to the level of the thing you're taking a photograph of. And you kind of, I think everyone intuitively knows that, you know, hey, a different perspective is cool. Also, there are lots of potentially cool perspectives, right? Their level is a way of getting an interesting perspective, but going completely nuts and shooting things top down that are rarely seen top down can be equally as cool and effective. Or shooting things from ridiculously low down that are usually shot at their level can also be really cool, right? So there are lots of alternative points of view that could give you even funner compositions, but a way of getting a composition that is very often very effective is to get at the quote-unquote eye level of the subject. And I'm saying eye level in inverted commas because you have the expected things that have an eye level. Kids. If you take a photograph from adult human head height of kids, You are literally looking down on them. And maybe your intention is to make a patronizing photograph. But if you want to get a truly open and genuine feeling photograph of a kid, hunker down and get that camera at their level. View the world like they do. Meet them where they are. They will open right up to you when you're face to face with them or face to camera with them. Right up with you. Their smiles will light up and the images will feel true and honest. Not patronizing, but true and honest. So for kids, just hunker down. Pets involve hunkering down a lot or lying down. But a dog at dog's eye level is way more engaging than a dog looked down upon by an adult human. And it's not just dogs and cats. It's not just our pets. It kind of works for everything, everything in the wild, wild world. If you can get at their eye level, you will get an interesting photograph. But eye level is fuzzy because flowers can be thought of as having a sort of kind of face. And if you have a sort of kind of face, then you have a sort of kind of eye. And so actually, a lot of my nature shots are taken of at really very, very low level to the ground. One of the joys of shooting with the iPhone is that if you turn it upside down, the lens can be millimeters off the ground. And so if you hunker down and hold the camera between your legs, you can get a shot of even the tiniest little wildflower from that wildflower's level. And the world looks very different from the point of view of a little primrose or whatever. And so shooting a primrose from the point of view that a primrose has, it changes things a lot. And it, even if the image is not spectacular otherwise, it'll stand out. It will get people's attention because that's they're used to looking down on that, whatever it is, primrose or whatever. But shooting it from its level is a completely different image, and it will catch people's eye. Another very useful guideline, one I'm very, very strong on, is to give room. So empty space isn't wasted in a photograph. Empty space is as important as the full space. Empty space is what brings harmony. And where you put the empty space around the subject is what's going to determine how harmonious your shot feels. So empty space is a major part of your composition. It's not something to be minimized. Oh, goodness me, no, don't crop everything tight. So you've got to use the white space well. And there's all sorts of, that has all sorts of effects. But one of the effects it has is that if your main subject is somehow lopsided and somehow is doing a lot of heavy lifting here, it feels uncomfortable when you center it. You actually need more of that empty space to one side and the other because it's lopsided. And so anything that is obviously in motion, it needs room to move into because otherwise it feels like it's about to crash into the edge of the frame. So if you have a photograph of a jogger and you frame them smack dab in the center, it won't feel right. It will feel cramped because mentally you know they're moving. So mentally it will feel harmonious and balanced when the runner has more room to run into than room behind them. Cars, trains, planes, boats, all if it moves, give it room to move into if you want it to feel harmonious. If you want to create a sense of tension, if you want to make people feel uncomfortable, don't just crop it in the middle. That'll feel like the sloppy valley. No, no, no. Crop it closer to the side it's moving into. Invert the rule. I tell you, it'll feel claustrophobic. It will feel really like, yeah, it's about to crash, right? It will hit you very strongly. And so this is kind of one to bear to try to balance with the visual weight. So giving things room to move into can mean that you end up with the visual weight being off unless you compose your image carefully. So you do kind of have to keep those two guidelines in mind together. But again, moving is easy. Moving is obvious. Okay, great. But it's not just about moving. The act of looking needs room to look into. So in a similar way, slightly more abstract way, to how something that's moving needs room to move into to feel not cramped. When you're looking, you're looking at something. And so we mentally like to give people room to look into. It just makes the image feel harmonious. So if you want to make an image feel really not harmonious, crop them at their nose. And the more someone is looking to one side. So the closer you are to the straight on, if someone's looking straight at the camera, then you crop them straight in the middle because the room to look into is on the Z-index, as we'd say in web design. But one, if they're looking the opposite of that, if they're looking at it exactly parallel or exactly across the frame, then you want to give them lots and lots and lots of extra room to look into and very, very little room behind their head. And if they're somewhere in between, then the ratio between behind and in front shifts. So if they're looking a little bit off-center, you frame them a little bit off-center, you get the idea. And the same is true for moving things. And then we get into that fuzzy abstract thing again. The same is also true of anything that's vaguely face-like. Flowers feel cramped if they're not looking straight at you, looking. You see, I'm using it again, right? It's an abstract concept that a flower looks. A flower doesn't look at anything. It doesn't have eyes. But nonetheless, mentally speaking, we project a pretend face onto them and we think about flowers as looking. And so if you have a flower that's looking off to one side and you crop it so that it's exactly in the center, it will feel claustrophobic as if it was a person looking in a direction. So remember, it's moving things, it's things with faces, and it's things that our brain sort of imagines have a face. Doesn't have an actual face, but our brain does it. Therefore, we're making photographs to please our brain. We're going to listen to what the brain says, not what the physics says. So pretend it has a face and crop accordingly. So my second last principle is a big one. There's a collection of guidelines here. Landscapes need a sense of depth. And the problem here is that reality is three-dimensional. Photographs are two-dimensional, so when you want to get a compelling photograph of a landscape, if you don't put the depth back, it will feel, and the word we actually use to describe photographs like this is flat, because that's actually a really good description of why they don't feel exciting at all. It's because they feel flat. So when you're standing in a big landscape, you as a human being are sensing the vastness of that landscape because you see in three dimensions. And you're also rooted in the spot. You're aware of your near surroundings, your mid surroundings, and your distant surroundings. And all of those things together give you a sense of the landscape you're standing in. If your photograph only captures the amazing vista without the rest of the context, it won't be an amazing vista. It will be boring as all heck. It will feel flat and uninteresting. Which means the only way to counteract that, to get a landscape photograph that shares with the viewer your feeling of the place, is to put back the depth. There's no one way to put back the depth. There are a collection of guidelines, at least some of which are hopefully relevant in every situation. If they're not, you're going to have to improvise. I have no advice for you. But there are four strategies that I find useful to help me put depth back into the world. The simplest to explain, and to be honest, the one I reach for first, it's the thing in my toolbox for landscapes that I reach for first because it's so darn effective, is the three-layer strategy. So I definitely want to describe that. The second thing I reach for is leading lines. I just love perspective. And it really makes an image feel three-dimensional when you have converging parallels or a long winding path getting smaller into the distance. That just immediately tricks our brain into seeing three dimensions again. So leading lines are amazing. A place to stand is a very effective technique. So imagine a photograph looking out over the vastness of the Grand Canyon, something that is inexpressible unless you're standing there, but you can get a hint of it. Not with a shot looking into the vague distance. Oh, look, there's the far side of a canyon and it's a long way away. Okay, academically, I can comprehend. Oh, that's a very big canyon. For it to feel like a big canyon, you need to include the near rim with something interesting. The rocks at the very edge of the near rim. And that will give the person mentally a place to stand in the scene. And then that distant other side suddenly falls into its amazing context. Oh, wow. That's one heck of a canyon. So a place to stand is a very effective way. And if you can't get three layers, leading lines, or a place to stand, then finding anything vaguely in the foreground to act as a frame around the background sort of think of it as a two-layer strategy. It's, I would say it's not as good as a three-layer strategy a lot of the time, but it can be the only thing available to you, and it can work very effectively. So finding a window to look through. It really could be as simple as a cityscape viewed where the window is framing the edge of the shot is way more effective than a cityscape without that frame. A landscape with trees framing some sides of it is way more effective than the landscape without it, right? It's finding something in the foreground to frame one, two, three, or four sides of an image, or maybe just one of your corners. It doesn't even have to be sides. It can be corners. Just something in the foreground to frame it, to give a sense of scale, to give a sense of distance, to put some amount of three-dimensionality back into the otherwise flat scene. So they're my four strategies. So let's dig in a bit on the three-layer strategy. That is, again, my favorite because it deals with all of the sort of the human problems. You get a sense of the depth from the fact that you will end up with three layers. And you get a sense of the detail that exists at the three scales because your layers are at the different scales. So you have a foreground interest, a mid-ground interest, and a background interest. So they're your three layers, foreground, mid-ground, background. And your foreground should capture a small detail of the place to anchor you to what you're standing in. The mid-ground is going to be something of interest sort of at our macroscopic everyday human scale, and the background is the bigger picture. And there are lots of ways you can have three layers. But as a general rule, you know, something right at your feet, something a couple of hundred yards away, and something in the distance. But you can mess about with it a bit. And this is actually one point where the visual presentation was extremely effective, because I was able to show lots of different examples. Sometimes an amazing cloudscape is your third layer. Oftentimes it's a distant silhouette of a mountain range or something, right? It can be something very distant and very, very subtle and abstract, but it gives a sense of the place because that is part of the place, that distant part of the scene. So that background layer in particular is very flexible. For the foreground, they can be the most banal things. A rock is an extremely effective foreground layer because that rock will be of a particular type with a particular texture and a particular color that is particular to the landscape. It gives a flavor of the landscape. Flora and fauna. Fauna tends not to sit still. Unless you're in agricultural land, then cows can be an amazing foreground if you're in Ireland, or sheep, or llama if you're in somewhere in South America, or goodness only knows what in Africa. Take your pick from their amazing range of wildlife. But you get the idea. So flora and fauna. The flora stays put. I tend to prefer relying on flora. But fauna works just fine if you can get it. Agriculture is amazing. A feeding trough, foreground interest, tells you a heck of a lot about a place, actually. Gives you an idea of the farming going on, of the humans interacting with the landscape, bring the human touch into your image. A farm gate or a field gate. So between flora, fauna, and agriculture, there's a lot going on there. And a lot of the time, the very, very, very simplest way to get something of foreground interest is to crouch down low. A lot of the stuff in the foreground, strangely enough, is at your feet. So rather than, you know, trying to find all sorts of complicated things, maybe it's a case of just crouching down a bit, and that's all you need to do. The other thing to bear in mind is that because of how perspective works, because of how distance works, if you move just a few feet left or right, you have a huge, huge change in the foreground layer. Stepping 1 foot to the left can be the difference between including a rock right at your feet and not including it right at your feet. Stuff in the midground, you can move hundreds of yards and not change it all that very much. And stuff in the background, you can move miles without affecting it. So finding the three layers is a lot easier than you think. Because I tend to think of it, okay, so the background layer catches my eye. Oh, wow, what an amazing sky. There's got to be something cool about here. Oh, yeah, there's a nice castle on a hilltop 3 miles away. Good enough. That sky will be just the same. So get yourself to the castle. So now you've got your background and your mid-ground. Okay, now what do I want foreground? Well, I can move for hundreds of yards until I find a nice flower, a nice farm gate, a nice bale of hay, a nice cow. Right, I can find whatever I want to put in front of that, or maybe some sort of little piece of, you know, if we're looking at a ruin of a castle or something, well, then some sort of piece of history will be nice to find. That will tell the story even better, right? an old crooked tombstone or something from wherever they bury their pets near the castle, or goodness knows what, right? There tends to, when you have something archaeological, there tends to be small little archaeological details nearby the big archaeological thing. So one of those would be an amazing foreground, really tell the story. But that freedom to move for miles and miles and miles without changing your background, and to move for tens, hundreds of yards without messing up your midground, that gives you a lot of freedom to find your three layers. So yes, it's true that you won't always find three layers. You'll find them a lot of the time. So it's actually an amazing first strategy, because it will work very often. And it's very effective. Leading lines are just something our eyes love. So if there's an amazing path pulling the eye into the scene, use it. Oh, free depth in your composition. There is an important caveat here. Leading lines are extremely powerful. They will visually pull the viewer's attention into the photograph, and they will guide that attention along the leading line. It had better lead somewhere. If you pull the viewer's eye to a giant big nothing burger, you will have yourself a nothing burger of an image. Yes, it has a sense of depth. It's still a crummy image. So leading lines are absolutely amazing, but they best lead to something. I've already talked, to be honest, about as much as I can get to say really about a place to stand. It's kind of like you're trying the three-layer strategy. You can find something in the foreground really low to the ground. It's your place to stand. It's going to anchor you. You only have one layer left. Okay, it's a two-layer strategy, not a three-layer strategy, but you know something? It can be surprisingly effective. So, okay, I can't find three layers, but I got two good layers. Well, great, place to stand, one of your layers, away you go. And foreground framing is the same idea, but it's not about where you're standing. It's about something else on the ground to give you a two-layer strategy. So I guess you could say, I can sort of narrow my things down to perspective. So leading lines are perspective. They're effectively infinity many layers. Three layers, or two layers. That's sort of how it breaks down. So there are my guidelines for putting some depth back in. And then the last thing that I have been really focusing my photography around the last couple of years is close-ups that are eye-catching. And the strategy that I've been using to get interesting close-ups is to do my darndest to give close-ups context. Put the flower in a place. Put the butterfly in a place. And that, there's lots of different ways of achieving that, but by giving close-ups context, you're telling a bigger story. It's a bit like the landscape. The castle is interesting. The castle in its place is more interesting. The flower is pretty. The flower, as part of a beautiful garden, is more of a story. The flower, as part of a landscape, it's a wildflower, it's part of nature. Where does it grow? That tells more of a story. But what makes it a close-up is that the attention, it's very much a game of two halves, and using that terrible cliche again, it's World Cup soccer time, folks, it's on my brain. Can't help it. I don't even like soccer, but it's still on my brain. It's on the news all the time. So what do I mean by that? Actually, it's not a game of two halves. It's really, really, it's a game where there is one very, very, very important thing and one secondary thing that helps a lot. It's a primary complement sort of a thing. When you're taking a close-up of a flower, the flower has to be the most important thing. Think of it like a soloist and backup vocals. The context is the backup vocals. I wish I thought of that while I was giving the presentation. Yeah, well, that's what happens when you give something a second time. So the thing you're taking the macro of, the thing you're taking the close-up of, that is the star of the show. That is Elvis or whoever. But the backing really does make a difference. And the backing is your context. So that means that, like, background vocals are designed not to compete with the singer, like background accompanying piano music is designed to complement the singer, not compete with the singer, your context should be a complement to the subject, which means it can be vague. It can be fuzzy, both conceptually fuzzy and genuinely fuzzy. Spectacularly out-of-focus backgrounds retain a sense of place. Like, spectacularly out-of-focus backgrounds retain a sense of place. And that difference between sharp focus on the subject and soft focus on the context, that hammers home the concept of soloist background. The subject is the flower, the background adds to it. So really, what I'm talking around here is a really big caveat in this whole context of giving your close-ups context is tread carefully, because there's a fine line between adding a sense of place and distracting everyone from your subject. Shallow depths of field is by far the easiest way to avoid that, right? If the background is fuzzy, it adds a sense of place. It is not going to pull the eye away. Lighting is another amazingly effective way to deal with this. So if your subject is in direct sunlight and the background is in shade, you will get a sense of that background, but it will be a lot closer to black than your subject because you're going to expose correctly for the subject. And that difference in light and dark literally puts a spotlight on the subject. That can be extremely effective. And you would be amazed how blurry a background can get and still retain a sense of place. And another one, which again, I didn't think of in time for the slides, but scale can be the difference. If your background has detail at a very, very, very small scale, even if that detail is in sharp focus or sharpish focus, but your subject is a giant big flower or whatever, if the difference in scale in the two scenes is enough for your brain to separate them out, you will still have a not distracting scene. But you got to be really, really, really careful the more in focus your background is, or the more similarly lit your subject and your background are. If you can't get a dramatic difference in lighting or focus, then you're going to need a difference in scale and you're going to have to be darn careful about it. I guess the other way is color. If your subject is, you know, a pink flower and it's set in a sea of green, very common in Ireland, that sea of green is a really important part of the story. Why is this one orchid so special? Because everything in this landscape is green. And then there's this one amazing purple flower. So the sea of green is the story. This pink or purple is amazing because it's so special in this landscape. And so if the color is uniform enough, the sharpness or not of the background doesn't matter, because the color contrast will give you that separation between your subject and your accompaniment, your background. So really you're looking at, there has to be a clear separation, sharpness of focus, lighting, color, or scale. So that, they are my guiding principles. So just four guiding principles. Pay attention, be attentive. Take the time to understand the quote-unquote rules of photography, the guidelines. Listen for and to your intuition. Don't be a slave to the measured. Be open to following your gut. That will make it your photograph after all. And assuming you're not working to contract for a customer, selfishly indulge your own creativity. It is a luxury we have. Live it. Make the most of it. Enjoy it. Be unapologetically selfish about your photography. It's your thing to express yourself creatively. And to help you do that, you can use useful guidelines like the rule of thirds, the visual weight, geometry and symmetry, shooting from their level, room to look into, finding ways to give your landscape depth, finding approaches to giving close-ups some context. But they're just guidelines to help you. The guiding principles are the key here. Much to my surprise, that hour-long visual presentation that was extremely photo-heavy has actually proved to be an equally long but utterly different verbal presentation. So look at that. I can talk for an hour without pictures, just like I can talk for an hour with pictures. Who knew? With all of that said, let's wrap things up for this month. Before I go, thank you oh so much to everyone who supports this show. We are at the end. There is very little to come. I'm going to say a few more things. It's going to be a nice theme tune. You're going to hear my audio icon, and then it's going to stop. You haven't heard an ad or a sponsor, and in the minute or two left of audio, you're not going to hear one either, because there are none. This show is 100% listener supported. I have the luxury of podcasting selfishly, because I podcast as an amateur, because I love sharing with people. I have gained so much value from the world of podcasting that I want to pay it forward. I would have enjoyed a career as an educator, but turns out that didn't work out how my life went. I ended up doing something else I find fascinating as a career, but I still like to indulge sharing knowledge. And so this is how I express that, through one of the ways, through podcasting. And I'm trying to break even. I can't afford to have the podcast be a constant financial drain decade after decade. So the aim here is to find an audience who likes what I have to share enough to contribute enough that it breaks even. Not trying to make money. I'm sort of trying not to lose too much. And I am amazed to say that I'm at episode 153 and we're still going. And it's entirely 100% because you folks rock. You folks keep the show alive. So thank you, thank you, thank you. You can do that simply by sharing word of the show, spreading the word among your friends and family, or you can contribute to the very much real bills that come in to make this show go. You can do that on an ongoing basis, which helps with the recurring bills that happen every month using Patreon. You basically pledge an amount every month, and I get that amount, and the regular bills can be paid. Yay! Or you can make a one-off PayPal donation, which I try to avoid pouring the PayPal donations into the month-by-month expenses pile, because that's not really sustainable. But as well as month-to-month expenses, from time to time I need new software, new hardware, I need other things to keep the show going. I need to invest in things. Sometimes I can invest in things like getting an actual creative professional to redo theme tunes and audio icons and logos and graphic design and stuff, because I don't have those skills. And I don't want the podcast to feel amateurish in the pejorative sense of the word. I wanted to feel like something I love and I wanted to express myself, but I don't have the skills to do it, and therefore I pay other people. And the way that's possible is because of things like the one-off support on PayPal. So thank you again to everyone who has ever made a PayPal donation. Thank you oh so much to everyone who contributes on Patreon. Without you, I don't know how I'd pay the bills. And thank you to everyone who spreads the word, because the more people know about the show, the more people there are who can click the Patreon or the PayPal buttons. And finally, just maybe thank you to everyone who's about to contribute. You will find show notes, in this case in the form of a PDF of the relevant parts of my slide deck, at let's-talk.ie. I have been your host, Bart Bujat. My personal website, in the sorry state that it is at bartb.ie, but at least you'll find links to my profile on glass.photo and stuff where you can enjoy what I actually have been putting my effort into. And until next time, happy snapping.